and Answers begins right now.
You're tuned to Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. Media today is transfixed with transgenderism. It appears to be the current fad, even labeling some with what's called gender dysphoria. Is there an evidence for this argument? What causes gender dysphoria? And are people born with this? Today on this episode of Evidence and Answers, Pat and his guest, neuroradiologist Dr. Stephen Willing, an expert in the human brain, discuss what the latest scientific research shows about transgenderism and gender dysphoria. Now let's begin part one of this two-part interview. Here's our host, Pat.
You're listening to Evidence and Answers, where we provide compelling evidence for faith and hope in Christ and biblical answers to the issues of today. We've been hearing a lot about transgenderism. Many in the popular media and the culture are making the case that gender dysphoria is genetic or part of our biological makeup. When it comes to issues like the LGBTQIA issue, you often hear the argument, well, I'm born that way, or God made me this way. Well, is there evidence for this argument? Well, joining us today to help us address this issue is Dr. Stephen Willing. Dr. Willing is a neuroradiologist and an expert in the human brain, and he's equipped to discuss what the latest scientific research shows in this issue. And he's published a work titled The Scientific and Medical Examination of the Transgender Issue. And so, Steve, welcome to Evidence and Answers, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Patrick, for having me. In fact, my son's name is Patrick, and we named him after the Saint Patrick who evangelized Ireland. A very inspiring story, made a huge difference in the society of his time.
Oh, fantastic. Well, Stephen, before we begin, just tell us a little bit about your background. You're a neuroradiologist. So what kinds of study and medical research do you do?
So that's correct. So that means I'm a licensed physician. I went to medical school. I then did a residency in diagnostic radiology, followed by a fellowship in neuroradiology. I was really there at the very beginning of MRI scanning. I was at UAB in Birmingham when they got their first MRI scanner, and then I was at the University of Louisville on faculty when they got their first MRI scanner back in 1985. So I've been that with this field from really the beginning of the modern area of neuroimaging. And mostly what we do is read CT and MRI scans of the brain and spine. We look at the inside, and I looked at tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of brains over the course of several decades.
Yes. Now, you did an extensive study with Reasons to Believe on the scientific and medical research on this issue of transgenderism. Just give us before we start defining terms and getting into it, just give us a general overview of this study.
Well, what we did, we had a team of four physicians from different specialties, including OBGYN and pediatrics and infectious diseases. We teamed together, we combed through the research, the published papers, and of course, all these are the scientific papers. We're not reading polemics from activist organizations, but just reviewed the data, took out a critical look, looked at what their strongest arguments were, looked at what their weakest arguments were, and looked at the methodology of their studies, but also we looked at the critiques of the methodology of the studies. And so many people have been out there going through these studies and pointing out glaring errors in study design, glaring omissions of data, misrepresentation of the data. So it's a very deep and complex area.
Yes. And one thing I appreciate, I've read on this issue quite a bit as well, but I really like the paper you folks published because it took a lot of these extensive studies and really summarized it really well. I think it's 15 or 17 pages, and you took some of these top studies and summarized it really well in a way that's really understandable. So I think this was very outstanding research that you folks all did.
Well, thank you so much.
Well, as we begin then in this whole issue of transgenderism, and the other issues are tied as well, the whole LGBTQIA issues as well. But first, let's define our terms. What is gender dysphoria and transgenderism? Let's define those two key terms here.
Good, because that's really important. Gender dysphoria is nothing more nor nothing less than a man-made diagnosis to put people into a box. It first appeared in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual Revision 5. The DSM is a tool that was developed for coding mental illness that enabled billing to insurance companies and allowed, documentation help maintain a medical record. It's not a Bible revealed on high. The DSM has gone through radical changes over the five editions that were published. So, and things that were a mental illness at one time were not a mental illness in subsequent versions, and vice versa. New mental illnesses are created, it would seem, out of whole cloth. Well, of course, that doesn't really happen. So what it is simply an attempt to keep up with the data. So nothing pertaining to transgenderism appeared in the first two editions. And the DSM-3 that came out, I think, in the 70s, they introduced the term transsexualism that talked about primarily adults who would want to transition, felt like they were born in the wrong sex and wanted to transfer to the other. And DSM-4, then they created the diagnosis of gender identity disorder, and that encompasses people of all ages. And that would describe people who were born male or born female, but felt like they should be the opposite sex, identified that, want to really live as the opposite sex. And so it was called gender identity disorder, the idea being that they suffered from a delusion. Now that can be a charged word. That has a very precise psychological definition, which is not disparaging in any way. Now, in DSM-5, there's a good paper where they explain the reasoning behind this. They wanted to depathologize this gender identity issue. They wanted to make it not a mental illness anymore. They wanted to normalize it, get people to think, well, this is just a normal phenomenon. Some people really are born, say with the wrong sex, their brain doesn't match their body. So we don't want to call that a mental illness, but they still wanted to treat, they still wanted to have a diagnosis so they could bill insurance companies and Medicaid them. So they changed it. They narrowed it to gender dysphoria. Well, dysphoria is just a term of basically bad feelings. You feel bad about something. That's dysphoria. Well, the people who were conflicted or were unhappy with their birth sex, that was the dysphoria part. So the idea here is that if, a boy wants to be a girl and he's very happy with it, maybe he's living as a girl, if he has no unhappiness about it, then there's no dysphoria and there's supposedly nothing wrong with it. But that's how the terminology has changed. So gender dysphoria is a very then narrow term. It mostly applies to mostly the younger people, but those who have been diagnosed both with a sense of conflict over their birth sex and experiencing unpleasant psychological effects from it. Yeah, so that leaves out all the people maybe who are quite happy in that situation. So we need a more encompassing term. So we use the term transgenderism for lack of a better, more accepted term.
Yes, now, what causes gender dysphoria?
That is a great question. And let me preface this by a huge, huge warning. Anytime you ask about human behavior or mental illness, if somebody comes back with a single answer, they are being grossly simplistic. Human mind just doesn't work that way. Human behavior is far too complex. I think it's more of a process. We can go back in time. Now, one thing we know that's a biological and scientific factor that people's behaviors along the spectrum of gender expectations varies. Okay. Some boys are more masculine, some are more timid and reserved. Some little girls are more feminine, some are very bold and aggressive. That's called gender nonconformity or perhaps gender atypia. And it's a perfectly normal, acceptable thing. When I was growing up, I think for most generations up until the present, we just say, well, we need to be less rigid in our stereotypes. We need to be accepting of these little girls who are not stereotypically feminine. We need to be more accepting of these young boys and young men who are not stereotypically masculine. And I think that is the correct moral virtuous position to take. However, in recent decades, some people in society have almost done a complete reversal. All of a sudden, now these stereotypes are determinative. These stereotypes rule. So if you don't perfectly fit the stereotypic masculine or stereotypic feminine persona, then maybe you're born the wrong sex. Maybe that feminized boy really is a girl. Maybe that tomboy really is a boy. So we start with a situation where little boys and girls, their behavior is along a spectrum, but that it doesn't stop there. We have to have a narrative. We have to have what the psychologists would call a schema. It's kind of, we want to put everything in boxes. We need a framework for interpreting these things. Now, like I said, in prior years, this gender atypia, we would interpret it as perfectly normal range of behavior. But more recently, we've established a different narrative, a different schema that says, well, no, this, we need to reinterpret this in a different way, that they may be actually born in the wrong sex, that this could be a real thing. Now, we can go into this later. There's really not any science to support that, but that's a starter. I'll let you get back to your questions.
Yeah, you stated there really it's not really supported by scientific data. That was kind of surprising when I read that in your paper. Many people, well, not surprising to me, but many people may be surprised when you're saying that. Tell us about that a little bit, that there really isn't scientific evidence for this.
Yeah, well, the narrative coming from some quarters is that you actually can, say, be born a man but have the mind, the brain of a woman, or vice versa. And there are many problems with that. It creates some sort of mind-body dualism that goes against scientific research of the last 100 years, that the mind and body really are one. You know, the developing brain, a little boy is exposed to circulating testosterone in utero. There's another surge of testosterone shortly after birth. And there's a big surge of testosterone at puberty. And this affects the developing brain. So a boy, even if you maybe grab him when he's 8, 9, 10 years old, he already has a masculinized brain. He maybe hasn't hit that third phase, hasn't hit puberty yet, but he's still already had the effect of testosterone on his developing brain. This concept that you could have a brain that's different from your sex, that's very metaphysical. It's kind of a spiritual woo-woo kind of idea. You know, Plato talked about the realm of being, the realm of becoming, and the realm of becoming is the one we're in. And everything we have in this realm, the realm of becoming, is just a physical representation of something that really exists in its most real and pure form in the metaphysical realm. They're almost hypothesizing such a thing with gender, that there exists sort of an idealized male and female persona in the metaphysical realm, and your body may not match that, but your mind can. Now, do male and female brains really differ? That's on a physical level, biologically. And that's very complicated. And the answer is sort of yes and no. You know, I've looked at, like I said, I've looked at thousands and thousands of brains over the year, and I could no more tell a male brain from a female brain than I could tell fish in the sea, which I'm not very good at. I mean, I just couldn't do it. So on a structural level, just looking at them, no. Now on Yet behaviors do different. It's well established that there are different male and female behaviors, especially in children, do have a biological counterpart. So there is some difference in sort of the wiring of the brains, but that's very difficult to assess using any sort of modern technology. The most reproducible difference is actually one of size, just because men have bigger bodies, they have bigger brains, but it has nothing to do with intelligence, of course. It's just a fact. But there are very subtle differences that emerge through imaging. And even when that has been tested, they find that, first off, you can't reliably tell. They say, claim that with some AI type processes, they can differentiate male and female brains with a fairly high level of accuracy. But most of the time, it's not much better than a flip of a coin. But there's very limited data so far, but where they have gone and look at transgender brains with the scans, you know, a trans woman who is born male, a trans woman, the brain much more closely matches a male. And a trans male who is born woman is much more closely resembling a female. So the trans people, when they do look at the imaging, their brains more match the sex that they're born then into than the sex that they may identify with. But again, these methodologies are very unreliable because there's a huge amount of overlap between these. So it's complicated, and we shouldn't try to oversimplify it, but there's really no evidence that a person literally could have a brain different from the sex that they were born into.
Yes, and we've noticed the spike in gender dysphoria. Why has there been such a huge spike here in people struggling with gender dysphoria?
Again, you're going to get tired of me hearing this, seeing this, but it's complicated. Okay. I mean, I've been practicing now for several decades, and over my lifetime, I've seen within the medical community, especially the mental health community, what we call an availability cascade. Daniel Kahneman wrote about these in Thinking Fast and Slow, but an availability cascade is when a belief sort of catches fire and passes through the population, and people end up believing up, not because of the evidence, but because everybody else seems to believe it. So they just, jump onto the bandwagon. We saw this in the 60s and 70s with multiple personality disorder. We saw this in the 70s and 80s with a repressed memory phenomenon. We saw this in the 90s that took off in the medical community, this idea that opiates weren't addictive and we were underprescribing them. That was never based on any scientific data, but it really caught fire and was a large, it was not the only factor. I mean, Mexican drug gangs were a factor too, but it was one of the major factors driving the opiate epidemic that took off in the 90s and 2000s. And Sam Quinones, if you're interested, wrote a book called Dreamland. He goes into this in detail. So what I'm saying is historically, we've seen things like this before where a belief becomes widely accepted and popularized and catches fire within the mental health community, and then eventually the data doesn't hold up and it collapses. Is transgender phenomenon and that? Well, ultimately you only know in hindsight, but it seems to be following that pattern. There has been a rise. The activists would suggest, well, it's always been present. It's only now we're more accepting of it and more willing to tolerate it, and they can, quote, come out. But that doesn't hold water. We have very good data on the prevalence, up through, say, 2010, where it was more on the order of 0.01% and 0.02%, and now we're well above that. Another thing we can do is compare it to baseline rates in other countries, because there's an acronym that these social scientists use called WEIRD, and I love it. It stands for Western, Educated, Industrialized, Rich, and Democratic. And mostly it means the Western societies, and you could throw in perhaps South Korea and Japan. And if you look at the weird countries, this is where transgenderism it seems to be really on the rapid rise. If you look at the non-weird countries, South Asia, Africa, we don't have much good data for Africa, but South America, we do have good data. If you look at the non-weird countries, there's been no spike. It's not taking off, and it remains at the same levels it was 10, 20, 30, 50 years ago.
Yeah, Steve, when people ask about gender dysphoria, I think a lot of teenagers struggle with it. Your hormones and it's kind of a confusing time. And I remember, in my teenage years, there were times I wondered. Seems like no girl wanna go out with me, But those in the gay community certainly did. And I always wondered, gee, something wrong with me here, And I was on a football team, but I also liked music. The music class I was in was all girls. I was the only guy in there, and I wondered sometimes, So I think teenagers struggle with this issue. And then when you have the things going on in our educational system, you're encouraged to cross-dress or being pushed on you that this is normal. A man could be trapped in a woman's body, or a woman be trapped in a man's body, or whatever. You get all of that. I think seeing a spike like this in the countries you're talking about, where this is prevalent in our culture and being pushed in our educational system, I think that would contribute, of course, to a spike we're seeing in the particular countries you mentioned here.
Yeah, so I can totally identify with you. I mean, I would totally put myself in the gender atypical camp. If given a choice between going to a symphony concert and a football game, I'd choose the symphony 99 times out of 100. That 1% of the time, they'd be playing, Penderecki or Lewislawski or something really harsh, dissonant, and hyper modern. But I think one thing that really seems to be driving this, besides the things I've already mentioned, is the internet and social media, particularly TikTok, Instagram, YouTube. You know, this isn't an isolated phenomenon by itself. It does seem to be part of a larger phenomenon of this thing affecting young people today, where too much time on smartphones, too much time on social media is leading to a list of problems. They're less socially engaged, they're more socially inept because they spend their time not in face-to-face, but virtual interactions on screens. It's caused to a much a dramatic rise in depression, anxiety disorders, loneliness. And you've probably heard, you seem very well informed, you've probably heard about Jonathan Haidt's new book, In the Anxious Generation. And he goes into quite a detail on all this. And he actually, within Anxious Generation, he does have a section on the explosion of gender identity disorder and points out the connection between social media and these notorious influencers who portray it as very hip and cool and liberating and the cure for all your problems. And if you take people who are already lonely, already depressed, already anxious, already insecure with their own position, and then you dangle this in front of them, it sounds like nirvana. It sounds like ambrosia. It sounds like almost irresistible that they're going to be drawn into this. So I think it really is crucially important to keep this in context of the bigger picture of the rise of mental illness among young people. And a lot of fingers are pointing to social media and screen time.
Yes. Now, tell us about the treatment of children and adolescents who struggle with gender dysphoria. From, having read your article, there seems to be a rush to begin treatment and activities like cross-dressing and then hormone blockers and then cross-sex hormone treatment. But there seems to be kind of a rush to start treating this right away. Is that correct?
In some quarters, that has definitely been the case. Now, up until, say, the early 2010s, the standard of care was what was called watchful waiting. Just, support them, treat other things that may be going on. Many times, these children who present with a gender dysphoria may have a history of abuse or childhood trauma. Many of them are on the autistic spectrum. You deal with the coexisting things and just shepherd them through this stage of life because there's very solid data. Every study that's ever been done shows that the majority of them will desist, which means when they get older, they will become at peace with their body. Whether it's, 60%, 70%, 98%, that kind of depends on which study you want to pick. But every study has shown that a solid majority desist as they reach adulthood. And that's really the optimal outcome because that means their bodies are left intact. No messing with their hormonal milieu, no, irreversible damage to their sexual organs. And they can, go on and function in life. Now, this kind of works backward how we got where we were. Now, so where they found with some of the older ones who didn't desist, then they would want to go on to surgical transitioning. But if they've already gone through puberty, it's much harder to get a man to look like a woman or to get a woman to look like a man. It's much harder if they've gone through puberty. So they said, well, what if we started sooner? Okay, maybe we could get a better result in the end. So this started in the Netherlands. It's the famous Dutch study where they enrolled a population of about 70 kids and started trying to intervene early with first they give puberty suppressors, then they follow that up with cross-sex hormones, so testosterone or estrogen, and ultimately to surgery.
Our time today has come to a close. Be sure to join us again here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, Contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number there is 483-0586. Or email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit that subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Once again, log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a great place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.